And now apparently there's a bit of an epidemic going on of people having vitamin D supplements. So it was great. It was a great news story. It's unfortunate that there's another fad like this, but it's a great news story to kind of reflect back on our study of vitamins. I don't know if any of you came to conclusions about vitamins on the basis of our study. I did come back to the idea that multivitamins might be good to take sporadically. But you remember we've talked about upper limits and all that. So that was kind of timely, I thought. Oh, and then there's also a pretty neat, well, it's kind of new research on the microbiome and studies in mice. And interestingly, mice given a lot of penicillin produce offspring that are less sociable than mice given. So if you clean out the microbiota of mice, they behave differently. Of pregnant mice, they behave differently. And then it's a neat study. So anyway, any food news for you guys? Where are we in food? Did you have a good food weekend? Did you get home cooking? Comfort food? No home cooking? Okay, let's get started with our material today and the project. We're going to try and aim for kind of a productive small group experience pretty soon. So what I want to do is kind of help, with your help, kind of revive your memory of the readings. But let's talk a little bit about what we're trying to do in this unit. So if you want to start taking notes, this might be useful. You remember I said that with the gastronomy and the study of vitamins, we were really trying to immerse ourselves in a field and then try as philosophers to figure out sort of what do we want to take from that study into our philosophy of food, right? And with this material, is a little more familiar in a way. That's a hard thing to do. That's something that, that just requires immersion and study and thinking about, okay, so what do we know about vitamins? What do we know about taste? How important is satisfaction? And what's terroir? You know, all those concepts that we studied in the last few weeks. With this unit, we're really moving back to a little more traditional philosophical method. The idea here is to figure out what your commitments are on values in food production. And to do that, I think we need some concepts. We need some concepts out of ethics. We're not going to kind of rehearse our whole ethics class, but I want to give you some ethical concepts related to the animal welfare and animal consumption discussion. Today's class is really not focused on whether there are ethical reasons to categorically not eat animals, right? So what I'd like you to do, let's start your notes here. Assuming it's morally acceptable to eat animals, our question today is, what are the right standards for the care of animals? Right? So we're not asking the whole question today. Everybody with me? We're just asking the question, though, assuming that it's okay to eat animals, because there's another class we're going to have where we're going to ask that question, right? There are two big categorical issues with, animal consumption. One is it okay to eat an animal that's only lived such a short portion of their life, right? And then the bigger question, is it ever okay to eat an animal? And so we're going to track the best arguments around those questions. And again, I want to suggest that our model, especially in small group discussion, is really more of exploring each other's intuitions and commitments. I don't think this is something our goal isn't to try to convince everybody of our positions. It's not polemical. Yeah.
We're not focusing on the main question, is it morally acceptable, but if it's okay, what was your...
Yeah, good. Let me mind, because that's a real good partition for today, to focus today's class. So if it's okay to eat animals, and that's a big if, we're going to return to that later, what are the right standards of care? Yeah, good, thanks. I kind of went fast over that. What are the right standards of care? And you're going to get introduced to a lot of data. You did get introduced to a lot of data through your reading. I'll remind you of some of that. And I'll kind of introduce a couple of concepts that might be useful in your discussion. Yeah. But like I said, when we get into small groups, one of the things philosophers do is they try to articulate their intuitions. And that could mean, like, here's where I am right now. Let me try to articulate the reasoning that would be around how I feel about this issue right now. That's one thing you might try to do in a small group. And then you might try to draw each other out and try to help each other kind of say how you're feeling. I don't think this is really the discussion to kind of try to have a polemical debate about it. I think, as I've told you before, I think philosophical diets are like religions to some extent. Advocates do cite objective reasons why they prefer their diets, but philosophical diets are choices that involve a whole complex of values, and so we're finally getting to some of the ethical values today. So a couple of concept notes, okay? A liberationist is somebody who thinks it's never acceptable to eat animals. Animal liberationists believe that we should stop reproducing domesticated animals. Ironically, this position involves a kind of something close to genocide. So it's a kind of interesting position. If you're really convinced that we are on the wrong track morally in eating animals, then you have to figure out why we would even keep animals around, animals for consumption. So the liberationist really thinks something horrible, in general, thinks something horrible has happened with human food practices and animal agriculture, and that it's exploitative. The original justifications were that it's exploitative, but now we have more justifications along the line of sustainability for not eating animals at all. The animal welfareist is more within the discussion we're having today. So we'll get back to the liberationist when we talk about, when we do some readings on whether it's okay to eat animals, okay? The welfareist position is really the view that we owe an ethics of care to animals and we ought to take care of animals using the best knowledge we have of their welfare. And that's a challenge because we know a lot more. That's one of the things that one of the probes for today. So the animal welfareists generally believe there is such a thing as happy meat. Happy meat's kind of a goofy phrase, but it just means meat that has been raised in a way that comports with welfareist standards. So these standards of care is what we're really going for today. Okay, questions about that? So one of the big categories that I wanted to kind of, I want us to kind of track in the readings today is natural behaviors, because there's a couple of levels of care. So if we're looking at standards of care, let's just distinguish two obvious levels. There's health and suffering, and avoidance of suffering. And there's something called natural behaviors. And natural behaviors are getting a lot of attention lately because we kind of forgot that animals have natural behaviors. In some cases, breeding animals for consumption has bred some natural behaviors out of them. In some cases, only industrial agriculture has really shown us what happens to animals when you keep them from being able to engage in natural behaviors. So now, there's plenty of examples in the readings of natural behaviors. I'll give you a gloss on it, though. It would include engaging in natural mating and nesting behaviors, and rearing behaviors of young. So not weaning animals too soon would be a way of preserving natural behaviors. It involves being aware of the capacities of animals, cognitive and emotional capacities of animals, and not committing them to a life which makes it impossible for them to do things that they intrinsically like to do and are capable of doing. Now, we have to figure out whether we should care about that, but some people are saying we should be caring about that. And then we have to keep an eye on this in relation to, what it costs to raise an animal. Okay, before we get, and that's one of the reasons I like the Estabrook article to start with. It gives you kind of a quick overview of that. Okay, but before we get into that, though, let's just kind of take a look at a couple of claims, and feel free to react to these initially if you want to. I just tried to pick a couple of claims that sometimes you want to, in philosophy, you want to try and probe, figuring out a couple of things that you think are pretty true going into the discussion, right? So you guys might want to add a couple of claims to this list, right? So one is, there's no law against abusing animals in agriculture, but there are laws against abusing other animals. So there was an elk poacher in the news, horrible thing. Some guy just went and shot like a dozen two dozen elk on his property and property around him and left the carcasses to rot. There, as you know, if you hunt, you know, I'm not a hunter, but there are laws against wasting meat. And so to kill an animal and leave it in the forest, you can get a hefty fine. You can be, are some of you familiar with these rules? Yeah. So that's a rule. What is that a rule? It's a rule about not wasting animals. There's also rules about how you can hunt animals. We also have a lot of we have a lot of laws against mistreating animals as pets. And so a second probe for me is we treat some animals for consumption in ways that we wouldn't allow people to treat their pets. And so as a philosopher, you want to be alert for inconsistencies. So is there a good justification for treating our pets better than we treat the animals we're going to eat? Well, yeah, we're more partial to our pets, right? We love our pets. We don't have to love the animals that we're going to eat. So that would be, you see what I mean? It's not an absolute inconsistency, but as good philosophers, you want to kind of notice when there's inconsistencies that haven't gotten any justification around them. So you you can go two ways. You can say, well, no, it looks like an inconsistency, but they're really different cases. We love our pets, and we wouldn't dream of leaving them out in the cold, but, you know, the animals that we're going to eat, we just don't have the same relationship to them. Do you feel that? Or you could also feel the contradiction. You could say, well, why? I mean, if the reasons we don't mistreat our pets is because it's not okay to mistreat animals, then why would it be okay to mistreat animals in this other case? Right? Do you feel it? Okay. So that's kind of something. That's the kind of thing you need to explore in small group. In some ways, until you're in a situation where you're actually trying to articulate this to each other, you don't always know how you're going to come out. Right? So talking it out is kind of important. I don't want to get in the way of that today. We have co-adapted and co-domesticated with animals. To me, that's a really important fact. It doesn't answer the questions, the moral questions, but this is not an arbitrary, in other words, it's not quite like slavery. You know, a lot of, you're going to read some people who make comparisons between animal agriculture and slavery, but it's a little different. Animal and plant agriculture are ecologically interdependent in some ways. And a final probe for me that the readings kind of remind me of is we just know a lot more about animal welfare than we used to. And so when we were raising animals on a small scale for consumption, the relationship between the farm and the animal was just direct, more intuitive. You read about farms where there aren't any people taking care of the animals. It's kind of automated. People show up when it's time to harvest, 1,200 chickens. But it's kind of a brilliant testament to American technology, right? That we can have these, that we can set up these pig and poultry plants. I think those were the two examples that are in such an automated way. That distance. I guess the point for your notes is that modern industrial animal agriculture has created such a distance between the human and the animal that the normal intuitive understanding that a small-scale farmer would have of what makes their animals happy, isn't there. And the objective conditions for making animals happy, for creating happy meat, just isn't there, right? So let's get into some of the... Does that make sense as an overview? Do you guys have any other claims that come to your mind that are kind of at the same level of, like, things you think that are true that are kind of probes to other things in the discussion? Anything like that? Maybe that's a good starting set for us. And some of these were motivated by the reading, so maybe you'll find others as we get into the reading. So a quick review of the reading, and then I want to get you talking to each other, and I'd like you to bring some material. We have a lot of details here, sorry. And then I'd really like you to bring some material back from the small group discussions that we can work with together, because sometimes we don't get enough time to do that. Okay. Let's go through the Easterbrook. Let's do the Easterbrook thing real quick. I think that was a short article. If you have it handy, please take it out. And I'd really like to get your impressions of it at this summary stage as well. So Easterbrook has written a lot of books on food. He wrote a really good book called Tomato Land, in which he talked really about what it means to grow tomatoes and who grows them and the conditions and all that. And that was really good. He has this is from his book on hogs. And so what is he exploring? He's exploring the difference between a $3.49 a pound pork product and this fantastic flying pigs farm pork that he ate for $15 a pound, right? And so he wants to know, as a journalist, what's the deal there? Is that worth it? What, I mean, that's a big price difference. It's almost fivefold, right? Fourfold price difference. So just a couple of details, and then maybe you guys have some details that you want to bring in. So Flying Pigs Farm is a 750-pig-a-year operation. In Singer and Mason, we come across farms that are 10,000, still small. And then the guy Bradley in that chapter references larger farms that have maybe 700,000 pigs a year harvested. So 750 pigs is really tiny. And you learn in this segment, right? Help me with this. You learn in this short segment from the book that the Flying Pig Farm that produces this incredible pork has some disadvantages right away. Does anybody remember some of the main ones? I mean, you learn about how fast commercial pig farmers can get breeding going, right? 2.5 times a year you can get sows to breed in a commercial environment. These heritage varieties don't breed as often. They don't have as large a litter. They, on the other hand, they retain all their natural behaviors. They know how to raise their young. They live on an incredible amount of acreage. Did you notice the space comparisons? Good, getting some nods on this, good. Space comparisons. And then there's a very big issue that comes across in both chapters about sow crates. The practice of raising pigs by confining breeders, the mothers, in crates that don't allow them to move around. And sow crates have been banned in a lot of countries. The U.S. still allows them. But, you know, the question would be, is that a violation of, that certainly doesn't allow natural behaviors, but it may be a it seems to involve a lot of suffering. It's a pretty horrible way to live. As you learn about this woman, a very interesting woman, Temple Grandin, she's a kind of advisor on animal welfare to the beef industry, and she's autistic, and that's important in a way to her appreciation of animal suffering in some way. She's an interesting figure. You can read about her. But anyway, the sow crates clearly seem to violate both of these standards of care. If you're asking about animal welfare here. So, what about some other details from the from this brief segment? So you kind of learn that at each stage of production, this may be a good way to put it in your notes. At each stage of production, from buying the piglets to raising them, the organic pig farmer is at a significant disadvantage in competing for price, right? Is that a summary we can put on our notes?
Yeah, like each step, you know, he pays more than the industrial. Like the butcher, they say they take
right.
20 to 30 pigs to this local butcher
right.
who does precise cuts.
Right, right. So industrial pig slaughter, isn't that crazy? Okay, so we remember that from our video early. Right.
Slicing one's body.
Right. And you have to ask yourself, well, so is that a very subjective thing that you might like the idea that these pigs were killed one by one in a different way? They cost a lot more to kill. So the starting cost is the price of the piglet, and the finish cost is not the final cost, but one of the finishing costs is the killing fee. And the killing fee, like you said, is related directly to how industrial the killing is going to be. But then there's little things along the way. Add this into your notes. This is kind of this might I'm mixing some things maybe from Singer and Mason, but you know if you're going to castrate a male pig, you can use anesthesia or not. Now you know it costs a little more to use anesthesia, but in the Singer and Mason this comes up, and the guy says, well, we don't have a dollar a pig to waste. You know, if it costs 20 cents, I could do it, but it's probably not going to cost 20 cents. So. So you have the point for your notes is we have a lot of things, events in the animal's life that could involve less suffering. That's minor compared to sow crates, right? So under health and avoidance of suffering, you could have use of anesthetics. Later in the cow section, you learn about you know, dehorning cattle without anesthetics and how it seems to depress cattle significantly. Whether we care about depressed cattle or not, you know, is another question, maybe. Okay, back to pigs. So one of the cool things here is we learn about the interior life of pigs. They're smart. They can express preferences. They socialize. They form groups. If you give pigs a few acres, they form nests. They even build, like, several. In another reading, I read that when they're about to give birth, they will build several nests for the new piglets and then choose the best one. As it gets closer to birth. And so they engage in, point for your nose is they engage in complex social behaviors. They explore, they play, you know, this is something that most of us without an agricultural background probably would have not a lot of familiarity with. Do any of you have any experience with pigs as kids or anything? No. Okay. The guy who cuts my hair wants to be a pig farmer again. His dad was a pig. So he tells me about pigs. Okay, so then you had a little bit of research on the, let's finish up with Estabrook here. I think that's most of it. The last gross detail in Estabrook, maybe you missed it, is that he reports that pink meat, he refers to industrial pig as pink meat, is injected with saline solutions to kind of pump it up, I guess, keep it from being dry and to add flavor. So when you pay $3.49 a pound for pink pig, what you're also paying for a lot of things that have been added in, growth hormones, this salt solution. Yeah, please.
I just have a question. Do you know if, like, maybe it relates to all meat, but also specifically pigs? Like, is that meat staying within the U.S., or are, like, we, like, consuming, like, our own, not just local, but, like, American pork, or are we giving and taking to other countries, too?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. The trade... U.S. trade in animal products is controversial because a lot of countries won't take our meat. Europe won't take our meat, right? You know this? Right. We're, partly because of, for a variety of reasons, partly one of the biggest reasons is that we give almost all animals growth hormones right from the beginning. Growth hormones in growth hormones and antibiotics can be used to increase production significantly. They can be in BST in cows, increases milk production. Europeans won't have BST. So we can't sell our milk and beef to lots of other countries because they wouldn't accept it. Now, are there severe health risks to drinking milk with BST? I don't get the feeling there are. But, you know, adding a lot of growth hormones to your diet might not be great just to help a farmer make 10% more or 5% more on a really industrial model. And then there's another issue with, there's another issue with exports of meat and agriculture. Yeah, good. Yeah. It kind of gets my attention when other countries' scientific communities conclude that they won't engage a practice that we engage in. It doesn't mean we're wrong. You know, we have pretty good science behind our judgments about what's safe in our products. But we're going to see a few examples of this. It's also with mad cow.
This is covered a little bit in reading, but I feel like the U.S. just, like, focuses more on, like, our making money off of it, whereas, like, in London or, like, England, for example, it's, like, do we have enough to even, like, give to our community, and then that's how they decide, and, like, it's more about the food and the person receiving it as opposed to us. It's about how much money how little can we produce to get the most out of it, and we're just, like, the pieces.
Right. One thing this course has really impressed upon me is that it makes a big difference whether a culture views its agriculture as an export product, because that's kind of what we do. We kind of say, well, how much of this can we produce? I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, we're trying to make money selling products. That's legitimate. I don't have any objection to that. But when you turn agriculture into an export product, it puts you under pressure to do things that maybe aren't the best. You know, and like you said, in another country, the issue might be, Are we meeting domestic demand for meat? In our model, it's more like, are we maximizing farmers' production and profitability? You know, I don't want to rule out that latter goal as legitimate. I just want to look and see if there's perverse effects from doing that. Remember, we saw that with soil because it makes you want to mine the soil to produce export food. So yeah, it's a good thing to bring up. Absolutely. Okay, so that was kind of the image you were supposed to get from the Estabrook article. It's a really kind of a hard-nosed comparison, and you learn some difficult things. Like the guy who's selling the really great pork, he's working his butt off. He's not doing that great. I mean, this is kind of, you want to believe that the $15 a pound pork is just happy all the way through. Like the people are enjoying a happy lifestyle, the pigs are happy, the customers are happy. But you learn from this guy's having to harvest and bring these, the meat and sell it directly to high-end vendors that it's not a picnic for him either. It looks better than industrial production. If you had to choose to be an industrial pig farmer or to try to do what he's doing, is it clear which way you would go? I mean, I think I'd take my chances trying to raise the best pigs, the best pork chops anybody's ever eaten. So, but that's kind of an issue. You might have a more industrial impulse about it. Okay, just getting into Singer and Mason, and then maybe you guys can help me do this, and we'll get to groups a little quicker. This has four segments, so you've got, three segments. And I added, Singer and Mason's good, but it's not the newest account of this, but it was one of the most famous, and Singer is Peter Singer, the famous ethicist, and Mason is a food journalist who's done some really good stuff. So I wanted to update some of these because there are a couple of things that are a little bit out to date. But if you're there with your laptops and you want to bring up some of these other sites, I've been all semester I've been telling you about Pure Air Dairy, and they kind of come into our picture today because if you're looking for comparison points, they wind up looking pretty good. In fact, I was just on their site in preparing for this class, and they boast for the first time that they're the only certified grass-fed organic dairy in the country, which I didn't know. Assuming that's true, that's pretty interesting. As I've told you, I just think their products are amazing. I don't know if you try them. You can get them at Huckleberry's and so on. I briefly went off their butter, because I was in a pinch, I had to buy some commercial butter, and not like lousy commercial butter, like Tillamook, which is still a regional industrial brand, right? The comparisons are amazing. You should try to compare, industrial milk to their milk. It's really expensive stuff, and so you might look at it and say, wow, how could I possibly work this into my diet? But give it a shot, at least as a gastronomic experience. And there's some other sites that I brought in here for updates. But let's try to do this efficiently. So in the pig section, in addition to what you learned from Estabrook, you learned that there's 90% fewer farms producing a lot more pigs. You know about the environmental footprint of a pig. The factoid from this section was that pigs produce four times the excrement of humans per day. I think in this other book this term, I ran across the figure for humans. Does anybody want to guess how much excrement humans produce a year? It's like, no. Take a guess.
700 pounds.
Oh, no, it's not that much.
Yes.
Somebody can check. It's a guess. It's okay to guess.
I can't judge if you didn't throw out a guess.
I think it's like 300 pounds. Somebody can check me on that. This book got What We Leave Behind. Thank you for taking a bold guess.
Too much.
So, you've read about this. Pig excrement's a big problem. Cattle excrement's a big problem. And so one of the things we do is we try to inject it into soil. We use these excrement injectors to get the excrement into the soil low enough, below enough to, that if the rain comes along, it doesn't all run off. So you get a little more information about pigs' interior life that relates to natural behaviors, right? You get the EU investigation on sow stalls. And then you get this discussion with this, small but industrial pig farmer, Wayne Bradley. And, he's you can feel the tension in the interview because he's opening his farm up to a journalist. He knows the journalist has critical questions to ask. We've already learned that a lot of these farms are completely off limits to visitors or consumers. Pure Air actually welcomes visitors. There are a couple of points, like with anesthesia for castration and limiting nursing to accelerate production, continuous growth hormone treatment. There are a couple of places where he kind of says, yeah, I guess that's not the best thing, but I got to do it. He's the one who had the slogan, there isn't a dollar a pig to spare. So he's running a tight industrial process, and to his credit, he says, well, look, we used to keep the pigs outside all winter. You know, they're in a nice, comfortable barn, 70 degrees. Sure, mm-hmm. they don't have bedding. They're lying on concrete, but they don't look unhappy on the concrete. You know, so what, one of the things I want you to take from these readings is kind of a sense of whether the standard of care is what you think it ought to be, what you think it could be, given the role that this food plays in your life. And notice that's not an easy question, because you don't need to eat animals to have a healthy diet. But there are advantages to having animals in your diet. Okay, any reactions to the Wayne Bradley segment? And then on milk, this is one where I feel some contradictions. As you know, I eat milk products, dairy products. I'd like to source more of them from this dairy that I like. Some of you could be checking out. I have a funny video to show you about this. Are you ready to watch this for a little break here? Maybe some of you caught this. This is very cute. This is a dairy cow. Our image of cows is that they just don't do anything. They just stand there. Why not lock them up all the time? They're not doing it. All right, check this out. This cow, watch what this cow does here. He's got a goal. I had to watch it a second time to get this goal. So that's the same cow now getting the third one out. Isn't that great? So that's, oh, yeah. Notice these are cows that have been allowed to keep their horns. Notice the kid is not terrified of the big horns with the pointy tips. It's meant to be. Now, I mean, you know, the connection to pets kind of comes through. It's like, well, so would you want your standard of care to be similar to a pet if you thought these animals suffered from not being treated as well as a pet? And it's kind of an interesting issue. And remember, we're not touching the question of whether it's morally okay to eat them. Friendships, emotional lives, pleasure in figuring something out. You read that in your reading. There's an issue about EST. I went to the wiki page to see who. This is one of those examples of something that we allow that other countries don't. So this is still true. Some of the claims in the reading, since it's a 2006 publication, you know, it's not up to date much past 2004. We need to check some of these things. Now, the veal story is interesting. This is one where I had to update because The impression you get from vegan sites is that that horrible things happen to male dairy cows, and that used to be more true. It used to be that and industrial dairy facilities weaned the calves way too early. We have very good evidence that mothers, cows, suffer. They express a lot of behaviors that suggest that they go a long time without forgetting that somebody just took their kid away from them after like 40 minutes of feeding. Because, you know, if you're really trying to run it as an industrial production thing, you don't want any of that milk going anywhere but to your customer. So the longer, Pure Air, by the way, brags about leaving calves for months with their mothers. I mean, that's a really luxurious operation. That's part of the reason their milk costs so much, right? So just like the hogonomics thing. But veal is really in decline, and so I did run across a farmer's site saying, look, you city folks, you don't realize that we're not sending these calves off to be eaten at 6 to 8 weeks in small farms so much. That is still happening in larger farms. And slight weird digression on this, you know. So veal's way down. So the problem with veal, right? Anybody? I actually ate veal at one point in my life. I stopped eating veal decades ago. What's the ethical argument against veal? Right? You eat the animal at like 8 weeks, so the animal doesn't have much of a life. You often keep the animal from moving so that it stays nice and soft. Some vealers are fed only on milk because it, you know, again, keeps the flesh tasty the way we like it. So the principal objection is that a vealer doesn't get to live very long. And we're going to look at, when we get to the consumption question, the big question of whether it's okay to eat the animals, we will have to confront this, but a cow has a 15 to 20 year lifespan, but even at Pure Air, those cows aren't living more than 18 months. So one of the arguments that the categorical abolitionist will present, the liberationist will present, is it's never okay to eat animals because we can't let them live very long. So we can't even let them live their lives. So we'll deal with that later. But the point right now is that in defense of dairy, it's veal consumption is way down. So it's not the case that dairy calves have to go off to veal production. They could go into beef production. A lot of them go, and I just started thinking about this in getting ready for the class, a lot of them go into pet food production, which is kind of interesting because it means that we're raising a lot of carnivorous pets for which we need to raise more meat, right? I mean, some people are trying to feed their cats corn, which is kind of not what cats eat, right? But we have these carnivorous pets, and so we need to raise meat for them, and so that's kind of an added layer of complexity. So you can still be worried about the fate of male dairy cows, but they can go into the beef production system. The big ethical issue is whether you separate them from their moms really early. So with beef, I don't want to spend too much more time on this one, get you guys talking in small groups. But with beef, you get a couple of journalists who got the idea of buying a beef cow because that allowed them to kind of track it. And so you get some stories about that. But the biggest problem, one of the bigger problems as we encountered earlier in the term, is feeding beef cattle corn instead of grass. And this produces a lot of health problems, so that kind of relates to our standard of care here. There's obvious sustainability issues. You ran across a research that suggested that fish genetics is altered in runoff into streams, something called endocrine disruption. Then you got the story about the happy Australian beef, right? So you also had my earlier food news from Crowd Cow about the beef at Curtis, Washington, that is pretty happy meat. I also found a local right outside Spokane, Rocky Ridge Farms is a local grass-fed organic beef farm. Okay, so what else do we need from the beef section? There's a detail in the Australian beef section that I wanted to get to. Yeah, the claim that stood out to me in this Australian ranch was that, given the size of the ranch, the claim was that it actually absorbed more carbon than it produced. And that's an interesting commentary on our early in the term, we had this research from the UN FAO, Livestock's Long Shadow, which was the basis of Cowspiracy. Remember when we started? And so the idea for your notes is that grass-fed ranches of a certain size can actually be ecological, and I've read other research on this. They don't produce as much beef, but they can actually not be carbon positive. They can be carbon negative. Okay, and then the last section talks about slaughter methods. Again, that would relate to a standard of care. And you also, I think this is where you also meet Temple Grandin. Okay. So here's what I'd like you to try to do in your small group work. Let's see, did we get most of this here? There was the site on mad cow was just to confirm that we did actually prohibit. So with this text, we didn't know for sure if the FDA banned beef, blood, and other animal products. You guys were too young to remember the mad cow outbreak, but this happened over the 80s. This happened over the 80s. It broke out in Britain, but there have been instances in lots of cattle had to be destroyed in England. There were a couple of outbreaks in the U.S., and I think there was one in Washington. But you do learn from this timeline that we did actually ban feeding animal products to cows, which is one of the reasons, one of the ways that they get mad cow disease. As you know, mad cow disease is suspected to be a disease that can affect humans and cause dementia in humans. And we don't know if there's how much of the current dementia problem to attribute to mad cow, because some people are getting more dementia because they're living longer, so it's really hard to separate that out. Okay, so here's what I'd like you to do in your groups. I'd like you to really get everybody talking, try to articulate, you know, what from this is consequential in terms of forming your standard of care. What are some of the tensions you see in trying to really create happy meat? What should we be for, given what else we've studied about nutrition and the role of meat in our diet? So try to talk this out and try to get back into the article and remind each other of some of the details. And what I'd like to hear from this isn't like a consensus. I don't think you should be trying to get each other to agree, you know, with anybody. I think you should be trying to explore the language that you want to use to articulate this standard of care. So when we get back, please, you know, take some notes in small groups so that we can talk together about how you're developing a standard of care for the animals that you may eat. Yeah, do you have a question?
Quick question, are there wild cows?
Yeah, well, there's... It's interesting you'd ask that. I was just... there are heritage breeds of cows. So I was looking at... Some of you have been to Florence, and maybe you had Bistecca Fiorentina. Did any of you try that? It's a delicacy. Right. That's made from a particular heritage variety of cattle. But to my knowledge, there are not wild cows. You'd be hunting, right? Yeah. Good question. Any other questions before we get into small groups? Okay, please give this some serious work. Try to articulate this. Finding language for your intuitions is a big step in philosophy. We'll give it about 10 minutes, okay? Here, I really do need to hear back from you guys about your experience in small group here. You know, there's a bunch of things I want to say to frame this, but I know I'd get in the way. There was one article I didn't share with you, and it was about emotional lives of dairy cows relative to separation from moms and dehorning, which is really apparently painful. So anyway, where are you guys on this? What kinds of How does this information affect your perception of happy meat? What's the standard of care that you? What are some of the elements of a standard of care that you think are reasonable? Like, let's start with what's easy. But also, just tell me what came out of your groups on anything. Even like graduation plans. Okay. Yeah. What do you think? Yeah, please start.
I'll finish it out. Culture kind of dictates whether the treatment is fair or not. So, like in India, you know, they treat cows like gold because they see it as their grandparents.
Yeah.
Here, we can just stack them together.
Did any of you feel like there's something fundamentally wrong about thinking of animals pretty much like industrial inputs? Because that's kind of a difference you're bringing up here. I think a lot of people in this country would just say, well, no, they're animals. They're just like the industrial inputs in making a product, right? Okay? What do you think? So then contradictions with pet treatment aren't a problem? You go with pet partiality?
I go with pet partiality. I just find that if they're cattle because we're allowing them to be cattle.
Right.
Kind of like...
They exist because we allow them to exist.
Yeah. And
so they exist at our
kind
pleasure.
Of food chain, we're kind
yeah.
of
yeah.
putting our dominance over them.
That's kind of... And if... I've got a great thought experiment for you guys. I can't wait to... But so theoretically, if there was an animal like bigger than us that ate us, we wouldn't really have a moral complaint against them. You know, if they didn't
yeah.
keep us in good conditions, it's like, oh, well, this kind of sucks, but, you know, they're the
yeah.
ones eating us.
Yeah, it would suck.
So the eater sets the rules, right? Sort of like the host. Yeah. I think that history's on your side. That's kind of the way we've thought about this. At least, well, I don't know, though. Because remember, you'd have to ask, how did humans think about the animals they ate prior to industrial agriculture? Because the question we're asking has never been asked before. You know, no one in human history has ever had to ask, can you treat animals like this? Because we've never had the technology to treat animals like that, right? So I mean, in some sense, you have history on your side, but in another sense, this is a really untraditional problem that we're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I was just going to say at the same time, like, their thought process was, I need this animal to stay alive for food, right?
Right.
As like that's what they were thinking
right.
along those lines. Right?
Right.
So like, I don't know. I think that's a really interesting question when you think about like what they were thinking as opposed to what.
Who's the they here? Contemporary farmers, but.
Just like way back when we were
right.
like hunting
right.
to stay alive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Good.
Like,
good to most humans in the past, animals were just a great way to store nutrition. So, I need this, and we've talked about dairying and gene culture coevolution, right? I mean, dairying was an incredible boon to humans. Oh, you got protein all winter. Wow. So, yeah, I think that's important. We're more distant from our relationship to animals, but we still, I mean, animal protein is, I think I agree with the nutritionists who say it's superior. It's really good. It's good to have in our diets. If, you know, if there aren't categorical moral objections to eating animals, then, you know, what about standards of care? Details? Did you get down to details? If you could vote today to ban sow crates, would you do it? Are sow crates legitimate? I mean, yeah.
The thing I was thinking of is like, how do you value the lives of these different animals?
Right.
And is one greater than the other? And if so, they are. Then why are they greater?
Yeah, my concern for an animal that has... Can you cash that out in a particular case? Can you give me a comparison?
Well, I'm just thinking of, like, a cow, like, smart, has complex social interactions
right.
compared to a chicken who, like, just run around, like, not seem as cute or sociable or more interactive.
Right.
Like, so does intelligence have something to do with how much more your life is worth?
You know, we used to... Yeah, so one thing we'll run into is a scale based on sentience, you know, some people argue we shouldn't be eating animals because they're sentient. But one way to drill down, you know, in a more complex way is to kind of allow that emotional life matters. So an animal can be pretty stupid by, you know, IQ standards. You know, we give them different tests and they can't do anything. But they could still have an emotional life that's important to them. And we, you know, so some of this new research on the suffering of animals is news to us. But some of it is stuff we never would have dreamed to do to animals before we figured out how to raise them in an industrial way. Yeah, others, please.
One thing that we talked about, which I didn't even think about, was
right.
the, like for cow, what, acre per cow?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, for different.
And it's an interesting concept because my family has cows. We only have like 10 cows, so it's not a huge amount.
Right.
So all the like that I eat comes from
oh, great.
Cows that
oh,
my family cool. raises.
Must be pretty yummy.
That's what Cole said.
Yeah.
But, like, we have a lot of acreage, and we, like, separate it into different pens, so they're not all in it. And it's more in the mountains. It's not, like,
that's neat. Right.
grass-fed, but we, like, plow or we, like, hay our fields
right.
and feed the cows hay. So, like, how does that play into an acreage per cow when you're not
directly feeding a cow on an acre of grass. You're like taking
right.
hay from our hay fields from other areas
right.
and feeding it to them like during the wintertime when there's snow.
Yeah, I mean, you still call them grass-fed, and,
yeah.
And I don't know, you know, but you say, so you've got two parts. One is the diet part, and so there's an animal welfare issue there, and feeding animals a diet that doesn't cause them to suffer, right? So that would probably be true there. In the Italian story that I linked today, these urbanites send their grass off to be analyzed. Maybe your folks do this too, to see what nutritional balance it has, and then they'll add things to the feed. That all sounds pretty good for the animals, right? But the idea, the big distinction in my reading has been between cows that are not allowed to, that don't have the room to move around, like feedlot cattle, versus cattle in a situation like your family's, where there's probably a lot of grass around during the summer, or no, not so much? So you hay during the winter?
Well, no, we hay during the summer.
Oh,
there's
okay.
snow on the ground in the winter, so
right.
they're outside, but they also have a barn, so like they can
right.
go inside
right.
under shelter from the snow, but it's not like...
The people who write on natural behaviors just, they talk about observing the cows being able to form relationships. I mean, I never knew before I studied this stuff that cows form friendships. Do we care if cows have friendships? If cows have the ability to show partiality to other cows? I mean, this is an 18-month life, you know? I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, one position you could take is, hey, this is a life that doesn't really have anything natural about it anyway. So... You know, so your standard of care could just be let's try and get some results. I mean, your standard of care could be on the minimum side just absence of pain. As a lot of farmers will say on their websites, you know, it's not in our interest for our animals to suffer, and I think I take them at their word. Generally, there's a congruence of interest between producing a healthy animal and producing a profitable animal. But you know, as you move toward more maximal elements, you know standards of care, you might include some of these. You might care about the weaning time. You might want to get rid of sow crates. You might care about acreage for both cows and egg layers. This is a big issue. You can actually compare eggs from chickens that had room to pasture and chickens that didn't. The old standard, as you know, was... for industrial chickens, was to have as much room as a piece of paper. So you'd get a whole chicken, you'd give them this much room, and then, of course, take the beak off because they're going to peck each other. And, you know, think about the price difference between, I just saw eggs at 89 cents for a dozen, and then the eggs that you can buy that aren't like this, where the chickens actually have room, they're like $4 or $5 a dozen. So one of the ethical issues is you could actually argue that it's unethical to advocate changes that would price these products out of reach for a lot of people. I mean, imagine you could make all of these ethical changes. About 30 or 40% of the country wouldn't be able to eat meat. I mean, you'd be able to eat it if you're moving into that upper middle class that we're all wanting to be in, right? Yeah, I can eat $15 a pound of pork. But there is a kind of social issue about whether you're benefiting the animals, but now you're taking a really good form of nutrition out of reach of a significant part of the population. All the burger places will close down. There's also an ethical, we're kind of closing up here, but there's also an ethical argument about, remember the pig farmer says he didn't have a dollar a pig to waste. One way to get at these, one reason we mistreat animals in animal agriculture is because of the market does exert significant pressures, real pressures on cost. And so one argument for mandates, that would be like legal rules that prohibit practices, is that it solves that problem. It creates even rules that all the competitors have to work toward. But if you passed enough ethical mandates on animal agriculture to satisfy, say, Singer and Mason, you'd have this problem of pricing food out of reach of a significant portion of the society. So even if you say, "Oh, yeah, this is great. I buy it all. It's great. Let's have happy meat." It's only going to be happy meat for some people. And now you might say, "Well, that's the way it goes. You can't fudge on the values." Some things on the list, as you guys were working, I was thinking, "Wow, well, are growth hormones and antibiotics part of a standard of care?" They can be in the case of chickens, because as we learned earlier in the term, chickens fed growth hormones don't develop bone structure normally. They fall over a lot. There's a high death rate. I don't know if there's similar welfare problems from growth hormones and antibiotics in pigs and cattle. There may be. I'm not aware of it. I don't know if artificial insemination is a problem on a standard of care. It seems a little gruesome to me, but scale might be a standard of care. You might come to the conclusion that that farms, industrial automated farms, can't be humane, because humane farms require a kind of relationship between humans and animals that can't survive a certain scale, right? Once you get to a certain scale, it's all going to be mechanized. So whether that matters, I don't know. Slaughter methods certainly matter, not just to animal welfare, but as you learned from the reading today, the way you slaughter an animal can affect the way it tastes, especially in the case of pigs. This is called taint, pig taint. It affects, you know, it's the reason we castrate male pigs. It's also the reason we might be concerned for ourselves about how we slaughter them. But then the other side of this is clearly a standard of care, because the way you slaughter an animal will affect its suffering in the last minutes of its life. And you might say, well, you know, I want to leave open the possibility that you can justify a standard of care that's close to the standard of industrial agriculture, but I really want you to give words to that, because I think articulating that is problematic. On the other hand, just going for a very high ethical standard of care could bump you up against a couple of these dilemmas. The final one I'll mention is this one, and we said this earlier, but I want to kind of remind you. Remember we said some of this is kind of like the attitude we take toward our coworker who rides his or her bike to work, right? There are things that it's ethically laudable to do, right? And you might say, wow, I wish I could do that. You know, I wish I could, you know, use less carbon, et cetera. Maybe that's on your list. But you have to ask yourself, is this, how big a sacrifice would it be for me to not eat, to only eat happy meat? How doable is that? Would I have to be an ethical hero to do that? And one way to get at that, of course, is to go back to the consumption rate. You know, the healthy consumption rate for muscle meat is, and that excludes, you know, poultry, is about a pound a week. So Americans are at about four times that. So if you're asking yourself, is it fair for me to price a lot of people out of the meat market, well, you're already paying for the health effects of a lot of people eating a lot of really crappy meat, right? You see where I'm going with this? So you could flip that around and you could say, well, no, it's not fair for us to bear the costs of people's overconsumption and at the same time cause so much animal suffering. So I mean, there's room, I think there's room in our overconsumption to consider the possibility that we might be a more ethical society if we raised our standards of care. I don't see how we could lower them much more. I mean, I think we're at standards of care that many civilized countries don't accept. So we'll kind of leave it at that. There's a lot more ethical territory to cover, so thanks for your focus.
Thank you very much. I have to figure out my whole life.